afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Here we go. And welcome to a sunny and warm February 11th. Go figure. I'll take it.
Okay, perfect. Of course, and at least it's not snowing today.
You bet. Okay. We started last time on this sequence of chapters, chapters 30 to 32. For some reason, I wrote 30 to 31 on the sheet. I meant 30 to 32. The sequence of chapters which include the fourth and fifth hois, so to speak. Literally, because that's the way Yeshaya spoke. Which last week we focused on the first part of it, where Yeshaya's message is that Egypt is going to disappoint you. Egypt is going to let you down. Don't put your faith in them. We talked about the issue of turning to Egypt for support. We talked about the issue of alliances in general. We asked the question of who exactly Yeshaya is speaking to. And we had one view, which is he's talking about the time of the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, when we know that they in fact do turn to Egypt for support. We noted the challenge of that. It really doesn't fit the context here at all. And the second idea, that he's talking about Yehuda in the time of Ahaz or Chizkiyahu, at the time of the Assyrian invasion, looking for Egypt to support them versus the Assyrians. And the problem with that was we didn't have any mention of such an effort in Tanakh at all. Now, it's possible that there was such an effort and it wasn't recorded. It's possible Yeshaya was actually successful here, and therefore you don't find out about an effort because they decided not to go. That could be. And then the third idea was that it's actually addressed to the northern kingdom. Even though that's not Yeshaya's standard stomping ground, we do know that they turned to Egypt for support against the Assyrians. We read that last time. So maybe that's who he is. That's who he is talking about. In whichever of these approaches you go with, the bottom line is, he says, you should not be looking to them for support. You're just embarrassing yourself by doing so. They can't help you anyway. That's Yeshaya's message. And there is collateral damage in seeking help from Egypt because of the shame that's involved and because of the undermining of the relationship with the prophet who's telling you don't do this, and therefore the relationship with God whom the Navi, the prophet, represents. We talked also briefly about the issue of churning, this issue of turmoil, of trying to do whatever you can to save yourself and not turning to God, a theme which we also saw back in chapter 22. And then we concluded with his third and last theme in that section, which is the theme of redemption, which we saw is reflected in chapter 30, and also in chapter 31, a vision of an ultimate redemption, the sun and the moon glowing sevenfold. We talked a little bit about that and what that sevenfold means. And that was really where we had left off, in the middle of this vision of redemption that's seen in chapter 30. So if you take a look in the Stone Tanakh, you're looking for page 1005. Still chapter 30. Sentence 29 is what we're up to. We had just done the bread and water image from sentence 20. And again, you know, as I've been saying, we're not doing line by line, but I'm picking out particular things that I think are worth noting. So take a look, please, at chapter 30, sentence 29. It's actually the top of page 1007. In which Yeshaya says, describing what's going to happen in this time of redemption, Hashir yiyelachem kalel hiskadesh chag. The song will be for you like the night when the chag, which we'll call festival, that's the way they translate it here, it's associated usually with bringing a karban, a chagiga, a festival offering, but like the night when the festival was consecrated, was sanctified. Visimchas levav, and joy of the heart, and he goes on, Kalech b'chalil, etc. So the song will be for you like the night when the holiday, the festival was consecrated. So first of all, the theme of the song is a very important one if we're talking about Chizkiyahu's time, because remember, we've seen already numerous times that Chizkiyahu was accused, based on a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, of not singing properly to Hashem, to thank Hashem, when we were saved from the Assyrians. So the theme of the song is really important here. But the night when the festival was consecrated, what night are we talking about? Bonus points if you didn't look ahead at the source sheet. Erev Pesach, Gita always thought. Gita thinks correctly. The Gemara assumes that we're talking about Pesach night, but not just that, but that what we're saying is, following the view that this is about the Assyrian invasion, the night of the Assyrian attack on Yerushalayim was Pesach night. That's the idea. That should not come as a shock to anyone who sings the songs at the end of the Seder. Right, Bechatzi Alayla. But also I think in Vamartem Zevach Pesach also. I think the songs there speak of the defeat of the Assyrians on the night of Pesach. I didn't go back to my Haggadah to pull the lines out and put them on the source sheet. You can dig your Haggadah out and keep it away from Chametz. But if you take a look at source number one on the sheet, the Gemara in Pesachim, Amar Kra. The text says, "Hashir Yalachem Kalel Hiskadesh Chag." The song will be for you like the night sanctified for the festivals. For the festival, Laila Hamikudash Lachag Taun Halel. The night sanctified for the festival requires Halel. Laila Shein Mikudash Lachag Ein Taun Halel. The night that is not sanctified for the festival does not require Halel. And the Gemara's point in context is that it's teaching us that Halel is required for Pesach Rishon, the first Pesach, not for Pesach Sheni. If someone is bringing the makeup carbon Pesach, Halal is not a required portion of it. It's only Pesach Rishon that requires Halal. But we make that association of having Halal on Pesach night out of this pasuk, which I thought was very interesting. Yes, Moshe.
You're saying that if you don't have a chagiga and a carbon Pesach, you're saying that you don't say Halal.
I don't think we're necessarily saying that. This pasuk does make it sound like it's linked to having the carbon. There is a classic debate about the obligation for Halel at the Seder if you don't have a carbon. Does it exist without a carbon Pesach? But I don't remember the debate well enough to speak to it. I am sure you will email me afterwards, though, with a full digest. Full digest is probably not the proper term. Full digest is kind of oxymoronic. Fine. Okay. That's one point I wanted to show you here. And then the second point that I wanted to show you is how the theme of music carries through in the rest of this section on redemption. Take a look again back at the verses, top of page 1007, specifically verses 31 to 33. Ki mikol Hashem yechas Ashur. From the voice of God, Assyria will be crushed. Bashevet Yaket, he will strike them with the rod. There actually are different ways to read those last words. Who is it? Is it Ashur who strikes with the rod, or God will strike them with the rod? Doesn't matter for our purposes. It's the next sentence that I'm really looking at. Vayokomavar mate musada. I'm going to translate it as they do here. The commentators also debate those words. It shall be that with every passage of the firm staff that Hashem shall place upon him, there will be drums, there will be harps. And the war, he goes on to describe the war against the enemy, against Assyria. But this is really interesting. What's the music doing there? Right? Along with the stick that is striking the Assyrians, along with the mighty blow against them, we also get musical accompaniment. Why? What's that about? Strange, no? I mean, just throw in music?
We always had the time we went into battle was with shofars.
Right, we always did shofar, right. We liked shofar a few times. But Tupim and Kino wrote, I mean, that sounds like after the battle is over, not during the battle. It sounds like Miriam at the sea. So if you take a look at source number two, following the dictum of trying to keep the source sheets shorter, at least until Gita goes to Israel. So if you take a look at source number two, I just gave you a quick table. Rashi suggests that, and this is based on the Medrash, it's referring to how the Assyrians fall. You know that we haven't seen it yet in Yeshaya, but the Assyrians are going to have this mysterious defeat where we wake up in the morning and the Assyrians don't wake up in the morning. And so the question is, what happened to them? And Rashi builds off of the Medrash that says they are going to hear the angels singing to God and they will be struck down. The tupim and kinorot, the drums and the harps, refer to the song of the angels. The Assyrians hear it, and they collapse. That's one approach which Rashi brings. A second approach which Rashi brings, the first Rashi is on sentence 31, the second Rashi is on sentence 32. He suggests another approach. He suggests that what's actually being stated here is the after the war is over, the areas they destroyed will rebound with joy and song. So it really is after the war, not during the war. By the way, that first idea in Rashi is actually pretty straightforward in the sentence. I hadn't thought about it before, but if you look at Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Ki Mekol Hashem Yechad Ashur, right? From the voice of God, Assyria will be crushed. So, literally, the celestial song, whether it's God's voice, the voice that is singing to God, those are both ideas in Rashi. Either the song is what leads to the downfall of Assyria, or the song is a product of the downfall of Assyria. And then you have Radak with a similar idea to Abarbanel, which says that God is going to pass through the Assyrian camp and destroy them, and therefore there will be song, because as the Pasuk says, Ba'avod Rishaim Rina, there is celebration when the wicked are destroyed. So therefore, it's a victory that is accompanied by music. Right? Songs to defeat by is what it sounds like. Okay. Last note in this point, in this section, takes us to chapter 31, sentences 4 and 5, the other part of the description of the redemption that we noted last week. And specifically, look what God compares himself to in saving the Jews. What does he say? What does God say he is like? A lion, that's one. And?
Birds.
Is that not a little strange? I mean, it's pretty standard. We're almost, inured to it. Like, God is a lion, God is a lion. Okay, fine, I get it. God is like birds. You do find in the Chumash, Al Kineshi Er Kinoa Gozalav Yirachif, the idea that God is like the bird hovering over the nest, Yisayu Alev Raso, carrying them on his wings. So it's not as though this is the only place that it's found, but it's an unusual image, and it contrasts with this idea of being a lion. So how are we supposed to take that? Well, Abarbanel says that the lion and the bird each have their talents. The lion is fearless. The bird flies from far away to help you. In other words, the bird, no distance is too far. The bird may seem to be remote, nonetheless is able to come in and assist. Other commentators suggest that the bird is swift. You might also suggest the bird resides in the heavens. There's sort of a comparison to God in the sense that it's up in Shamayim, it's up in the heavens, and yet it's able to help you here on earth. So that could be another approach. Okay. So we are told that Geula, redemption, is coming. It sort of wraps up chapter 31 with what we said last week and what we're saying this week. I'm going to come back to 30 and 31 because there was something I wanted to do last week. I didn't do it last week. I'm pushing it off to the end this week. And that was to look at some of the really fun language that was in chapters 30 and 31. But before we do that, I wanted to do 32 so that we see this as the unit that I think it really is. So the beginning of chapter 32. Did people have a chance to see 32 in advance? I saw some yeses. Okay. So chapter 32 begins by saying when that redemption comes, then chapters 28 and 29 are going to be reversed. Remember, this section that we're reading started really in chapter 28. That was the beginning of our hois, in which Yeshaya warned them about the fact that they're not listening. They mock their prophets, that whole tzav latzav, kav lakav thing, right? They're self-indulgent. They drink a lot, and therefore they're not able to learn, or they're not willing to learn. So a key element there in chapters 28 and 29 was our refusal to follow the prophets. So in chapter 32, the beginning of the chapter, sentences 1 to 5 on page 1007, we are told that now the nation is going to listen. And the reason why we're going to listen is one man, King Chizkiyahu. King Chizkiyahu is just awesome. That's what's going to emerge here. If you wanted to just sort of sum it up, he's the best. Take a look, please. We're going to do a quick read-through of these sentences because not everybody had a chance to see it, and it's worth getting a chance to see it. So chapter 32, sentences 1 to 5. Hein letzedek yimloch melech ulesarim lemishpat yasoru. So I'm going to follow the translation here, but come back to it to challenge it a little bit later. He says, Hein letzedek yimloch melech, the king will rule for the sake of tzedek, for the sake of righteousness. The officers will govern lemishpat, for the sake of justice. Vayayish kamachavei ruach veseser zarem. A man, it doesn't just mean man, it means Chizkiyahu, as the commentators take it, is going to be like a shelter from the wind, a shelter from the zerem, from the stream of water. They do it here as a downpour. But not only is he a shelter from bad weather, Kifalge Mayim Bitsayon. He will also be like pools of water, as they translate it here. Streams of water, pools of water, in a dry area, Tsayon, right? A ruin. Different from Tzion, although some may argue for a comparison. Kitzel Sela Kaved Be'eretz Ayefa. Like a shadow cast by strong stone, thick stone, in a land that is ayefa, which could be exhausted. Here they render as thirsty. But he's going to be unbelievable, Chizkiyahu. He's going to be shelter. He's going to provide you with water. It's going to be great. Velosish ena einei ro'im. The eyes of the onlookers will no longer be covered up. The oznei shomim tikshavna, the ears of those who listen, are suddenly going to pay attention. They are going to hear. Ulavav nimharim yavin ladas, the people who had been hasty and therefore they didn't understand, now they're going to understand. Ulshon illegim timaher ladaber tzachos, the tongues of people who stammered, who couldn't speak fully, now they will speak clearly. Lo yikare od naval nadiv. The person who was a naval, a repellent person, will no longer be called generous. In other words, you won't see flattery where they give somebody a title he doesn't deserve it. Ulchilai lo yeyamer shua. And to a person who is not willing to help others, a person who is stingy, they're not going to call that person generous. It's a beautiful image of justice being asserted at the hand of King Chizkiyahu. Are we clear on the passage?
Just the word.
Where are you reading? Velosish enayinei ro'im. So I'm going to come back to that very shortly.
Okay.
If you want to cheat, you can go back and look at 28:11 and 29:9-14. It's the verses that I refer you to here later. But don't cheat. It's okay.
Shoah,
we'll get there.
What's the origin of Shoah?
Which one? Where are you looking? Oh, Shoah there? Yes, so it's a term that is often used for somebody who is described as being generous. It could come from, I'm guessing now, to be smooth. To use that term for a surface that is smooth. I wonder if that isn't the association. But, I don't know offhand the etymology of it. I suspect it's related to being smooth. So this new king who we're talking about is going to set everybody straight is Chizkiyahu. Worth noting, though, the opening sentence here, sentence one, Hein letzedek yimloch melech, which is a really great line. I feel like if someone has to do a benediction of some kind or an invocation when someone is like being installed as a president or something like that, like that's a good line to use. Hein letzedek yimloch melech. I like that. There's some dispute as to how to read that. The usual way is the way I read it, which is the way Malbim reads it, which is that it's a prediction. This is what Chizkiyah is going to be like. Take a look at source number 3 on your sheet. I brought you the Malbim. All of this, the plenty, is going to be in Chizkiyah's merit. He reigned not for war and conquering nations. That's not why he became king. Only for righteousness and to oversee the nobles to conduct their offices justly. To make sure that they do what they're supposed to do. It's a description. However, Rashi reads it as prescription. Source number 4. For righteousness the king will reign. The law of the king is not to reign, but to practice just law. Meaning, it's an instruction. Letzedek yimloch melech. If you want to know why one should become a king, what a king's job description is, this is an exhortation. Pursue justice. It's a command. And then the other part of this sentence, ulisarim lemishpat yasoru. If you didn't have the English translation here, how would you translate this line? Yasoru means to rule, right? Sirara. It's part of the word sarim. But if you had to translate this, hein letzedek yimloch melech, the king will reign for justice, and then what? And so will the princes?
And as the princes.
So there we go. That's exactly our problem. Gita versus Janine. Gita says, in parallel to the first half of the sentence, the king provides justice, the officers provide justice. Janine says, no. And as for the officers, they shall rule with justice. The problem is the Lamed. Ulisarim. Or ul sarim, depending on how you do shavaz in a case like that. Ul sarim lemishpat yasoru. Gita says, ignore the lamed. It's like vis sarim lemishpat yasoru. The king will reign for justice, and officers will rule with justice. Janine says, you can't ignore a lamed. The lamed's there for a reason. So the question is, how in fact do you read this? So Rashi and the Malbim take the approach that the king is going to judge the officers. Ulisarim, and as far as those officers, he's going to keep them in line. That's the way that Rashi and Malbim read it. However, Ibn Ezra, Radak, and Abarbanel say, no, go with Gita's approach. Ignore the Lamed, don't worry about it. I brought you Ibn Ezra in number 5 just to show you. Vilamid, Vilasarim, Lo Yadati Lo Tam. He says, I don't know what that Lamed is doing there. But he says it's not alone. There are other Lameds I don't know what to do with also. And he quotes you 2 other verses, which you can look up if you want later, there are Lameds that don't seem to really belong in the flow of the sentence. And he says, ignore it. It means the king is going to practice justice, and the officers are going to practice justice as well. This wasn't really necessary in order to understand the chapters, but I just really liked this Lamed and the trouble it causes. Okay, but again, keeping in mind, eyes on the prize, what are we trying to understand here? What are we learning here? When the redemption comes, there will be justice executed by Chizkiyahu. And who is Chizkiyahu going to shelter? So Rashi says he's going to shelter the rest of the 10 tribes. After Sennacherib invades and exiles the 10 tribes, not all of them disappear. We learned this when we did Ezra. Right, we saw that there were members of other Shvatim besides Binyamin and Yehuda who were living here and were exiled with us to Bavel. So Rashi says here that that's whom Chizkiyahu was sheltering. He's sheltering the remnants of Yisrael, the northern kingdom. Radak and Abarbanel disagree, and I brought you Abarbanel on source number 6. Like the shelter of a stone behind which people shelter from the wind, so Judea will rely on Chizkiyahu. It's the people of the southern kingdom. They're going to rely on Chizkiyahu to protect them from Sennacherib. That's the idea. He's going to be a shelter on their behalf. By the way, Malbim has this great passage here. I didn't bring it because I felt like it didn't need to be brought word for word here. But Malbim says if you look at the shelter that's provided in the Psukim, you get the four elements. Right? It's shelter from wind and rain. You see that right in the beginning. It's shelter from fire and shelter from what? From earth. The Eretz Ayefa is the earth. So he says there's shelter from all four elements. I thought that was interesting. But going back again towards where we're focused here, sentences 3 and 4 predict that now people will finally learn. And if you take a look at source number 7, Gita has been very patient. I refer you back to chapter 28, sentence 11. This was about the nation that refused to listen to the Navi, refused to listen to the prophet, right? Ki bilagei safa uvelashon acheres yedaber el ha'am hazeh. He will speak with la'agei safa, and we explained at the time, either he doesn't know how to speak, right? That was Abarbanel's approach, or they mock him as though he cannot speak. That was what the other commentators said, and therefore they refused to learn. And then jump to chapter 29, sentence 9, it's at the bottom of page 1001, and you get Hismamahu usmahu hishta'ashu vashou. Right? So you wanted to know where we get this idea. Different word. But when you get you asked about the idea that their eyes are going to be covered, hishtashu, yeah. That's here. It's that they are, as they translate here, utterly blinded. Of course, the first reference to this we saw was in chapter 6, when he said, Hashmein lev ha'am hazeh, ve'enav hasha. Right. But the idea here is that what happened in 28 and 29, the people's refusal to learn, which continues in chapter 29 there, all the way through sentence 14, you can look at it and see, that image is now being reversed. Now the people will actually learn. And that's what you get in our chapter, going back now to chapter 32. Is that Chizkiyahu is going to implement national education. You see it. I mean, we read it, right? Chapter 32 is the bottom of page 1007. So what he said was, now they're going to see, now they're going to listen, now they're going to understand. The reason why I emphasize this is because of a Gemara that I learned as a kid, but always didn't have any clue where this connected to anything in Tanakh. It's just something that rabbis made up. Like, where did you get this from? Take a look, please, at source number 8. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, like many Gemaras. Sanhedrin's a big place. So the passage here is quoting from something we saw earlier in Yeshaya in chapter 10. I actually quoted the beginning of this Gemara when we read it in chapter 10. No doubt everybody remembers chapter 10 because that was only a year ago. A little more. V'haya b'yom ahu. On that day, his burden, the burden of the enemy, will leave your shoulder, his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be destroyed before. The pasuk says, seems to say shemen, right? So it's either before oil or before strength. But the Gemara reads it as though it says oil. So if Yitzhak Nafcha said, the yoke of Sancheirav was destroyed before the oil of Chizkiyahu burning in the synagogues and study halls. How is it that Sancheirav was defeated? By shemen, by oil. What do you use oil for? We use oil to illuminate so that we can learn. What did he do? What did Chizkiyahu do? He planted a sword at the entrance of the study hall and said, anyone who doesn't study Torah will be stabbed with this sword. This is effective. Look. They examined from Dun to Beer Sheva and did not find anyone who was ignorant. From Gebet to antifreeze. Did not find a boy or girl, man or woman, who was not expert in the laws of Tumah and Tahara. See that? That's all you got to do. Where does the Gemara get this idea from? And the answer is, look at our description here in Yeshaya, in Parak Lamed Beis. When Chizkiyahu comes around, he is going to institute an education campaign. And everybody is going to hear, everybody's going to see. And it's funny, the element the Gemara adds is the sword. Meaning the idea that Chizkiyahu is instituting this and it's a successful education campaign is actually pretty clear in the text. The novelty is that he had to stab a sword in order to do it, but on the other hand, that may be the most realistic part of the whole thing, is that you need to do that. But that's what that's, I think, a key root for this vision in the Gemara of Chizkiyahu's educational success. One other note that I can't resist. If you take a look at chapter 32, sentence 5, the beginning of the sentence, Yeshaya says, "Lo yikare od le'naval nadiv." No longer will they call the repellent person generous. So Barbanel comments and says, "Don't get your hopes up." He says it doesn't mean never again. It means in Chizkiyahu's day, right then there was no flattery. But yeah, flattery is going to be a part of the human race for a very long time. That's a Barbanel's somewhat cynical note on this. Okay, yeah.
I just find it interesting that he talks about Ish Be'Ishah.
Yes, the Gemara is very clear. It's everybody.
Everybody.
Yes. I wonder as I read it, and I don't have any answer to the following. When you bring purity and impurity, Tuma and Tahara specifically as the example, do you mean to say, because these rituals are really important for having a temple, a Beis HaMikdash, or do you mean to say these are esoteric and difficult laws? To everybody post-Beis HaMikdash, the answer is easy. These are esoteric and difficult laws. But to people who live in a world in which this is part of daily life, it could be means these are practical relevance, and they're relevant for men and women. Because everybody engages in this. Everybody has to deal with their truma and their produce and going into the Beis HaMikdash and all of these different issues. So I'm not sure how to take the Tuma and Tahara, whether it's saying that it's practical or whether it's saying that it's arcane.
Or that no one's doing it and they have to...
Right. Well, that would be part of the arcane view, yeah. So the text continues to say that on that day, corruption is going to be reversed. You can see it in sentences 6 to 8. I don't have much to add, so I'm jumping those, but you can see for yourself this beautiful image of the end of corruption. And it takes us to the top of page 1009, where we turn to the women. The sentences 9 to 14. Okay. So, Nashim sha'ananot, kona shimana koli. Oh, complacent women. Complacent is actually a pretty good translation for sha'anan. Sha'anan suggests somebody who is at peace, someone who is tranquil, but not just that they're tranquil, but they feel like, I'm safe, things are good. So complacent, I think, is actually a really good rendering of that word. He says, rise up and hear my voice, Yeshaya says. Banos botchos. That does not mean women of emuna. What it means is women who are self-confident, who think that they're okay. Ha'azena imrasi. Listen to my speech. And he goes on to say, yamim al shana tirgazna botchot. He says, time is coming when you're going to tremble. Roges, you'll have turmoil. Ki kalavatzir osef b'liyavo, because the batzir, the grape harvest, is done. No more asifa, no more harvesting. And then he goes on to tell them, either you are going to shudder, you will be in turmoil, or to command them, you should shudder, you're going to be in turmoil, you've got trouble coming. And you go on, you can see, he describes eulogy and grief, he describes the land in ruins, he describes the palace destroyed. The big question, though, is... Well, the first question is, I thought things were good. Where did this come from? We were just describing redemption. How'd you do that? Right? You had such a nice flow going. Egypt isn't going to save you. Sorry, Dad. Egypt is not going to save you. Trust should be in God. Chizkiyahu is going to come. He's going to bring justice. There's going to be great redemption. But, all you complacent people... Not so fast. Trouble is coming. So you could look at it and say that, what's a perek in Yeshaya without rebuke? Right? You sort of like, you can't go too long, at least till you get to chapter 40, without messages of rebuke. And that's one possibility. Ibn Ezra, though, reads it differently. He says this is addressing the Shomron, the northern kingdom. Right? Because that's part of this, the fall of the northern kingdom before the southern kingdom is saved. He solves that problem of what this rebuke is doing here. But what was particularly interesting to me, and I included it in one of the advanced questions that I sent out, was how does this relate to chapter 3? Go back, for those who didn't get a chance to look at it in advance. That's the one with the women. You got it. Chapter 3.
Oh, you asked what the difference was.
Yeah, I did. Well, I asked who these women are. Go back to page 959, chapter 3, sentence 16. Our scroll in their margin tells you, fate of the immoral women. As opposed to our section, which is parable of the complacent women. So clearly we know these are two different groups. One is the immoral ones, one is the complacent ones. That was a joke. Take a look, though, what he says. He talks about how Benot Zion, the daughters of Zion, are haughty, walking with outstretched necks and winking eyes, walking with dainty steps, and so forth. And then he goes into this long description of that we read. We talked about this at the time. It's a while ago. About all the different types of jewelry that are used for impropriety and that are going to be lost. Is that the same group as the women here?
I think it could be.
Gita thinks it could be. Okay.
Bad. They're both bad.
They're both bad. They're both female. Yeah, complacent and immoral are two different traits. If you wanted to zap them, like I would have just picked on the immoral part. Right? If I had to pick on one of the two, I would go with immorality as the worst crime. Unless you're going to say, well, complacency fits into his general criticisms here, which is true.
If Nashif Shana Not is addressed to the Shomron ladies,
yes.
Then Benot Zion, presumably Zion is meant for Jerusalem ladies.
Yes. So if you take Ibn Ezra's approach, this is referring to the northern kingdom, then clearly these have to be different women because they're in different places. Zion is Yerushalayim, Shomron is the northern kingdom. But even without that, this is, I think, a different group, and the commentators, the classic commentators, nearly universally, in fact, render it as a different group. The women in chapter 3 are actually women, meaning it's talking about the matrons of Jerusalem who conducted themselves in a certain way. That's the way the commentators tend to take the part that's in chapter 3. Even though, in that same chapter, women is just a term for the ruling class at one point. That means these powerful women. That's the way that passage is understood. Here, though, commentators take the term women as a metaphor. It's not about women at all. Take a look at Radak, whom I brought you on the sheet in source number 10. He's one example. You could also look at Abarbanel. You could also look at Malbim. He says, it said this regarding the cities of Judea, which thought themselves tranquil and safe. He said to them, even though you are safe now, you will come to turmoil. It's not a reference to women per se. It's the cities are being expressed in the feminine form. You thought you were safe, and in fact, you are not, and therefore this section calls upon them to grieve and to fear. Again, as I said, Ibn Ezra believes that this is talking the northern kingdom. However, Rashi and Abarbanel say no, it's Yerushalayim, because they ultimately will be destroyed by the Babylonians. Radak brings you both approaches. Take a look at source number 11. He says, this entire section is for the future, the time of Mashiach. Or, the prophecy is about the destruction of the cities of Israel, meaning the north, Yisrael, and their exile in the time of Hoshea ben Elah, who is the last king of the northern kingdom. The meaning of the phrase, the palace is abandoned, is then about Shomron. That's the idea that Ibn Ezra had as well. And also the Judean cities taken by the king of Assyria. So it's Judea, because some of Judea will fall to the Assyrians, and the consolation of until he pours out upon us, etc., is in the time of Chizkiyahu after the plague upon the Assyrian camp. So you have basically, at this point I've quoted you, basically all possible reads of who it is. It could be Yerushalayim in the time of the Assyrian, or not Yerushalayim, Yehuda in the time of the Assyrian invasion. It could be Yehuda in the time of the Babylonian invasion. It could be the Northern Kingdom in the Assyrian invasion. It could be from Mashiach's time. It could be anybody. Yeshaya could be warning anybody not to be complacent. I think in context, Ibn Ezra's works really well. The idea that this fits as part of the call to the Northern Kingdom, the only weakness of it is that Yeshaya, once again, does not normally speak to the north. So that's what makes this a little bit challenging. But again, to make sure that we're not losing the flow of where this is, because I think that's the most important thing for us to come away with here. So flip back to the first side of the notes and the outline of the structure that I gave you at the top. Right? Our fifth hoy, which started chapter 31, was again this reiteration, Egypt is not going to save you. God is going to save you from the Assyrians. We started chapter 32. Hezekiah was going to restore justice. Injustice will be run out of town. And then you get the section against the sha'ananot, the fearlessly self-indulgent, as I called them there. And then we get to the last section, which is redemption is indeed coming. Don't give up hope. And let's take a minute to see these sentences. 1009, starting in sentence 15. We'll do a quick read out of the English. Until a spirit from on high will be poured out upon us. The devastation is going to last until there is a spirit from on high, a ruach, in fact, poured out upon us. The desert will become a fertile field. The fertile field will be reckoned like forest. We're going to come back to that phrase because that's a problem. Justice will dwell in the wilderness. Righteousness will live in the fertile field. The product of righteousness shall be peace. The effect of righteousness, quiet and security forever. My people will live in a peaceful domain and in secure dwellings and in tranquil resting places. There's the word sha'ananot, but now it's a positive thing. Hail will come down on the forest. That's one read of the word barad there, is that it's hail, and the idea is on the forest and not on you. And the city will extend down to the valley. You will be so fortunate to sail upon all waters, sending the ox and the donkey to roam freely. Very nice image, right? Bucolic. Right? Everything is going to be good until you start chapter 33. So this ruach, the spirit that God sends, is generally understood as ruach ratzon, that God is going to desire you. Ibn Ezra is the sort of holdout in this section, but because he's the sole holdout, I'm leaving him on the side in approaching this. But you get this arboreal transformation going in sentences 15 and 16. Does that remind us of anything? This arboreal transformation. I just like saying arboreal. It's good, no? But what does that remind us of?
We talked about Carmel.
We talked about Carmel in chapter 29. I was worried because it takes us so long that like people wouldn't remember anymore. So thank you. If you take a look at page 1002, 1003, sentences 15 and 16. I'm sorry, that's not the sentence. This is sentence... I noted it on the sheet. I blanked. Sentence 17. Yeah. Sentence 17, we were told about when we sin, when we're doing bad things. Halo od ma'at mizar, in just a little bit, vishav levanon la Carmel. Levanon will become Carmel. Va Carmel la yar yechashem, and Carmel will become yar. The standard rendition, although not the only one, Livanon, is like the cedars of Lebanon, or reference to Jerusalem and the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Carmel is usually rendered as a field that has nice produce, and Yar is a forest. So is this a good thing, a good transformation, or a bad transformation? For the cedars to become like the Carmel, fields with produce, for the Carmel to become like a wild forest, how exactly are we supposed to look at that? And especially now, when in our section we are told, the Midbar, the wilderness, will become Carmel. And the Carmel is going to become a forest. So, how do I do this? So, I tried, in number 12, to bring you a table. I felt this would be a good way to sum up the different approaches, and especially to compare the way that the commentators took each one, because Radak has his view, Malam has his view, Abarbanel has his view. So Radak, back in chapter 29, said that actually it's not a vision of punishment, it's a vision of an arc that is coming. Meaning, there will be a period of decline and then growth. Lebanon is, you can look at my table there, Lebanon is tall, Carmel is low growth. And then you will be Yar, tall growth again, forest. And so Radak here says, Midbar is clearly ruined. No one thinks Midbar is a good thing. Midbar is a bad thing. That's going to become Carmel, which has produce and a few trees. That was not as good as Lebanon, not as good as Yar. And then you'll become Yar, you'll have many trees. Radak said, the original prediction was, things are going to go bad and then get better. But here, it's entirely on the upswing, because you weren't starting out as Lebanon, you were starting out as Midbar. So Radak is consistent in his read of what's going on here. He's okay with it. Carmel to Yar is good. Lebanon to Carmel is bad. Midbar to Carmel, good. He's fine. Malbim is also consistent. Malbim thought chapter 29 was good. Take a look at the table. He said, Lebanon, sure, these are cedar trees. You can't eat cedar trees. There's no fruit. So Lebanon, no fruit. Carmel has fruit, but it's weak. Yar, he imagines, are fruit trees. So therefore it is strong, and it has fruit, and therefore it's an uptick. Malbim is happy in chapter 29, and so similarly here, Midbar to Carmel to Yar is also great. Midbar has nothing, Carmel has something, and Yar, boy, that's the height. So Malbim is also consistent. Abarbanel has a problem, and I think he knows it, because he gives you two explanations, and his first one is inconsistent. In chapter 29, he said Lebanon is the best. He didn't give you much description. He said Lebanon is the best, Carmel is middle, and Yar is worst. You're declining, he believed. Unlike Radak, unlike Malbim, he said chapter 29 was a prediction of straight decline. But here, his first approach is to say Midbar is bad, Carmel is good, and Yar is good. I don't understand. Back in chapter 29, you said Yar was the worst. How did that happen? And that may be why Abarbanel offers you a second read. And he says, maybe what it's doing is this. Midbar is bad. Okay. You start out bad. Carmel is good for us. And the Yar is bad, it's talking about the enemies. It's not talking about us. This is like what Yeshaya does elsewhere, where he says, things will be good for you, and they will be bad for your enemies. So as he reads it, what it's telling us is, your Midbar will be Carmel, and the enemy's Carmel will be Yar. That's the way that Abarbanel resolves the problem. This is the sort of thing where we could spend more time on it if we wanted to really make sure we grasp what was being done, but I feel like diminishing returns a little bit on it. It's a very interesting thing, because you see this image clearly, at least to me, the main thing that Yeshai is trying to do here is to show you the reversal again of chapter 28-29. Before, I had images of Lebanon, Carmel, Yar. Bad things were happening to you. Now it's Midbar, Carmel, Yar, and you're on the upswing. Before, you refused to listen and you couldn't learn. Now you'll have your ears open and you'll be able to learn. What Yeshaya is doing is he is reversing chapters 28 and 29. And he says, when that happens, the people's tzedakah will lead to shalom. And he concludes with sentence 20. Right? He concludes with sentence 20, in which he says, Ashrechem zor'ei al kol mayim. Ashrechem, it's wonderful. You are so fortunate. You will plant on every water. What does that mean? To sow upon all waters. So two different views. Rashi and Abarbanel say, you plant righteousness. It's a metaphorical planting. Radak and Malbim say, no. Wherever you plant, you will find water, and therefore your plants will grow. That's the idea. So we end this chapter on a high note. Things are really positive. Now let's go back and look a little bit at language. Go back, please, to chapter 30, sentence 1. We're going to see some fun stuff here. It's in source number 13 on the sheets. So in chapter 30, sentence 1, he is rebuking, right? The end of the sentence, he says, he talks about the children who have strayed, the sons who have strayed, lest you think that he only rebukes the women, right? He has plenty of stuff about the banim throughout the book, so don't... Well, he had benot Sion, but he has much more about the banim. But he says, these wayward sons, these wandering sons, he says, they sin, leman sifot chatat al chatat, to add sin upon sin. What's interesting to me about that is chapter 29, sentence 1. Go back a page. In which he had declared to Yerushalayim, Hoy Ariel, Ariel, right? We talked about the Ariel, Mizbeach and Ariel. The Sifu Shana al Shana. I want you to add year to year, meaning I want you to go right, do what you're supposed to do, and then you will be able to add year to year to stay longer in the Beis HaMikdash. Sifu Shana al Shana. But instead of following my counsel of Sifu Shana al Shana, add year to year, chapter 30, what are you doing instead? Leman sefot chatat al chatat. You add sin to sin. You see? It's an image that's across chapters. There's also, of course, a famous pasuk, Leman sefot haraval hatzmeah, but that's the less germane, I think. To me, that was interesting. Second point that I wanted to make just about language is chapter 30, sentence 6. You see that? The opening of the sentence? In page 1003? Masa b'hamot Negev. This was talking about the payoff you're going to send to Egypt when you ask them for their help. Masa b'hamot Negev. The burden that you're going to send on the animals to the Negev, to the south, right? In that dangerous territory when you send all your wealth to Egypt looking to bribe them to support you, right? Verses, sentence 27 in the same chapter, bottom of page 1005, right? Divine vengeance upon the enemy. You see that? What does God say He's going to send to the enemy? You have to read the Hebrew to get it. Masa'ah. Right. God is going to send a burden upon them. What he's saying here is, you're sending your masa'ah of wealth to Egypt. I have a far more effective masa'ah to send, and that's going to be the punishment that I'm going to send to the enemies who betray you. So I feel like he's playing with the listener. And of course, whenever you read Yeshaya, especially after everything that we saw in chapters 13 to 23, Masa means prophecy, right? Over and over again, it was a prophecy of punishment. That's a separate note here. Last point in this business about fun language. I feel like I've become such a language geek ever since I started on Yeshaya. But take a look at chapter 30, sentence 25, page 1005. I feel like this is a major insult that he's offering here, not unlike something he did in chapter 5. What does he say is going to happen in this time of redemption? He says, V'hayakol har gavoa v'al kol givan nisa'a, on every high mountain, on every elevated hill, they will have plagim. Those plagim again, right? The streams of water, the pools of water, yivlei mayim. B'yom hereg rav, on the day of great killing, b'nefol migdalim, at the fall of the migdalim. What do migdalim mean to a reader of Yeshaya? Sorry, Uziyahu, Vayiven Migdalim. Uziyahu is the builder of Migdalim, of towers. Way back in chapter 5, we read him also make an allusion to people who build Migdalim, who build towers. He's knocking Uzziahu. You think you are a builder of towers. God is the builder of towers. The people who build towers, those fall. That's the image that Yeshaya is bringing here. It's that even though Uzziahu is gone by the time of this prophecy, he's speaking to Uzziahu's heirs. And he's saying, all those towers that you put your confidence in, you vested your wealth in, forget about them. Okay. Some other points from within these chapters. Chapter 30, sentence 6. Can't skip the flying snake. If you flip the page to source number 14, you'll see him there. We already saw a Saraf Me'ofef once before in chapter 14 when God talked about punishing the Plishtim. That was part of the prophecies against the 10 different enemies. So God invoked the Saraf Me'ofef, the flying serpent, to punish the Plishtim. Rashi here, as well as Malbim in chapter 14, say it's not a flying snake. It has venom that it is able to project from afar. So I would note to you that actually I did some research on this a while back. There are two kinds, at least two kinds of snakes when it comes to conveying venom. The ones we're used to thinking about are biting snakes. However, there are also spitting snakes. This comes up, I did the research, because the Gemara talks a lot about fear of snakes biting into something and injecting venom, or potentially spitting venom. So they actually have spitting snakes, particularly the spitting cobra, which is found throughout Africa, and that's the link I gave you in source number 14. You can read more about it from the Encyclopedia Britannica, for those who are not traumatized by images of spitting snakes. Rashi also says here that it can jump, so that helps with the flying thing. But if you remember, when we read this back in chapter 14, we talked about the fact that in 14, it was about bringing the snake to punish the Philistines in the south. And here, in context here, in chapter 30, sentence 6, it's about punishing those who are in the south once again. And so I pointed out then that land, the western Negev, has been home to poisonous snakes. And so it made sense for that to actually fit. Janine noted at the time that Dan, as well as Shimon, are associated with the snake. And they act against the Plishtim. So it actually fit quite nicely with that geographic area. Moshe, you were going to say?
Yeah, there's no possibility that this Sarah is an angel?
I wondered about it. The commentators don't seem to take it that way. And I feel like they would if there was a chance to associate something in Yeshaya with angels. But I haven't seen that suggested. Let's not say it isn't found. But I haven't seen it. Okay. Yeah, why not? I suppose. But the commentators they seem to read this as like a real world thing. They talk about whether snakes jump and they don't have wings. Like they're cool with this idea as like a something that is found and not some divinely created penalty to be used at some specific point. Last point for today, and then we're going to come back next time, God willing, and do a little bit more of the language here before we jump into chapters 33 to 35, which are really the next unit here. And the last unit before we return to story. So, if you've been waiting for narrative to return, that's chapter 36. But I couldn't resist this one, even though it has nothing to do with anything besides that it's not a sentence that we read. We saw in chapter 30, sentence 18, Ashrei kol chochei lo. Fortunate are those who wait for God. Right? So take a look at the Gemara here in source number 15. Lopachos alma mitlasin vishisa tzadiki. The world has no fewer than 36 righteous people. The mekavle ape shchina b'chol yom. They greet God daily. Shenamar, like the pasuk says, Ashrei kol chochei lo. Fortunate are those who wait lo lamed vav for him. Lamed vav is 36. So this is your source for the 36. For the Lamed Vav, Ashrei Kol Chochei Lo, that refers to the Lamed Vavniks, as they are colloquially called. There you go. So you've learned the source for those 36. God willing, next time again, we'll do a little bit more of the language at the end, from 30 to 32. There are some things here that don't add to our understanding of the chapters, but they're so important in Judaism in general that I feel like it's irresponsible not to at least visit them. And then again, we'll start on 33 to 35. Thank you very much.